Sauer.
This is Naomi Janowitz, and we're going to be talking today about the reliability of published research. Now, that's a pretty deep end of the pool to dive into, so we're glad that we have some help. So first of all, I just want to welcome our specialist, Vazir, here. So Professor Vazir, welcome to our show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Okay. So she is going to guide us into some pretty deep water. So I already mentioned and talked a little bit about on the previous show, that was 2 weeks ago, when I was introducing our themes, that one of the things the listeners can do is reach over on your internet and Google this famous paper, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False, Ioannidis's paper, which has been downloaded, I think, something over 2 million times,
said.
It's just one of the most widely downloaded papers there is out there. Yeah. Now, you're going to say you're going to download it, and you're going to start to read it, and you're going to go, this is a little bit difficult. Well, that's what universities are here for, right? We're here to help everybody understand something that, at the beginning, seems just a little bit complicated. So, first of all, I'd just like to hear a little bit, just so that the listener audience gets to a little bit to learn about you. How did you get interested in this question of whether published research findings are false?
Well, my field is social psychology, and you may or may not have heard that we're kind of in the eye of this storm of replicability and reproducibility and whether what we're doing is real. So biomedicine is one of the big fields that's come under scrutiny, and psychology, and in particular social psychology, is another one that's really felt the heat. So it was kind of unavoidable to be confronted with this issue. And then also within my field, I have several roles like journal editor, and I teach research methods. So I had to really think very hard about how are we evaluating research. Are we believing too many things, you know, too easily, and should we be raising our standards? And that's really what's at the heart of this debate.
So there are two important points made there that I want to emphasize for us. First of all, that it partly has to do with some fields are more under the gun than others right now. And you're in a field that is under the gun about replicability of research findings. So it's probably people in your field might be downloading this paper reading and thinking about it. The second point is that some people in the world end up having a certain type of responsibility where greatness is thrust upon them, where because of the role they're playing, they have to try to face certain questions head on. And there you are a journal editor. So you're one of those people that's going to say, yeah, let's publish this so that somebody like me and like many of our listeners is going to hear it and read it.
Yeah.
And so that's an important position.
And especially I think social psychology studies a lot of topics that people are inherently very curious about, like what makes relationships work or what makes a good leader or, you know, why are people attracted to each other? These are topics that do make the news when we publish a paper. And so we have, I think, an extra responsibility to be really careful about whether we're publishing things that are true, whether the conclusions are calibrated, whether we have a good system for catching, you know, sloppy research or flaws in research. And there was a lot of evidence that journals were not doing their job. I mean, it wasn't anybody intentionally letting bad stuff through, but the system that we had was turning out to let a lot of stuff through that later didn't replicate.
I'm sure that's true. If you look back at the long scope of history, like I study, there's probably been a long history of people publishing things that people weren't exactly sure whether it was on a papyrus or whether it was put on a cuneiform tablet.
And that's the nature of science, right? And in fact, when I talk about this stuff, the title of my talk is Safer Science. And the idea is that there's no such thing as safe science. If you're going to do science, you're running the risk of making an error.
Right.
And we shouldn't try to completely eliminate that risk. And then the question just becomes, are we making more errors than we should be willing to tolerate? And that's really where the debate is in our field.
Well, there's always the famous Winnicott, the good enough parent, the good enough mother. So question is, maybe we're looking for the parallel in the world of science.
Yeah.
A good enough scientist.
Exactly.
Because you can't expect a parent to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And you know that scientific research is going to be outdated. That's part of the nature of science.
Yeah.
So if we turn to this paper, my first question is, why is this paper so popular? I mean, it's quite striking to me that it's pretty technical. It's pretty hard to read. But it's been widely downloaded all over.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that it makes very, very bold claims, like in the title of the paper. And in the first paragraph, he talks about it can be proven that most research findings are false, which is, you never see that in science. People don't talk about proving things or make such bold statements. Not never, but it's pretty rare. The other reason, so this paper actually came out in 2005, and I would be curious to see the history of the downloads, because my guess is that it became much more popular after about 2011, when this issue really hit you know, there, at least in psychology, that's when it hit. But I think across, you know, in the broader public as well, there was a sleeper period where he'd written this article, but it hadn't really had its impact yet. And around 2011, a number of things happened in psychology, including some cases of fraud, a paper that was published in our flagship journal in Social and Personality Psychology that claimed to prove that ESP is real. So that caused a lot of self-examination in our field.
So if you're just joining us now, we're talking about the famous paper, the many time downloaded, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. And the 2 points we just made about why this paper has become so important, I think they're really good and they're worth emphasizing. The first one is that the paper has a catchy title. Right? It makes a bold claim. So that's something to remember, that we're humans when we look at stuff and if somebody makes a bold claim, you know, it wouldn't be very interesting to read, or maybe wouldn't be quite as interesting to read a paper that said some of the things you read may not be true.
Right.
So part of it is the way that the paper. Now, the second thing is one could say this is the Van Gogh of science papers because it wasn't purchased a lot during his lifetime. You know, that certain papers, and this is, again, a very interesting topic, which I don't think we're going to be able to go to in great detail today, but it does raise the point that just some papers are not particularly widely cited when they're first written, but their time arrives later, that something about them catches people's interest. So he may have been very catching an early wave in what only later became a tidal wave. And that's kind of interesting to see how he was part of this development.
Yeah. Ever since 2011, I keep thinking this year is the peak, but every year it just heats up even more. And in fact, just a couple months ago, there was a new book by Richard Harris, an NPR journalist, called Rigor Mortis, which is basically just expanding on the ideas in this paper.
Well, it'd be great because we're going to read the article, so we don't have to necessarily read the book form of it all. So terrific. Well, when I asked you which corollaries you wanted to talk about, because he has six dense and interesting corollaries that he outlines in the paper, and we will work our way, I promise everybody, we will work our way through all of them. But the one that you said you wanted to talk about first is number four. Do you want to tell us why you think this is so important?
Yeah. So I think a very common misconception, and not just among lay people, but among scientists themselves even, and this has been shown in surveys of scientists, is that we think that because we have this rule that a finding has to be significant at p less than 0.05 before we conclude that there's a real effect, that therefore we're limiting ourselves to making a false conclusion only 5% of the time. That's what the 0.05, that some people think that's what that 0.05 does, by saying we have to have an extreme enough result that there's less than a 5% chance it would happen if in fact there was no effect, then we can't be making a mistake more than 5% of the time. And that's absolutely not true. That's not how that 0.05 works. We could be making a mistake 100% of the time. And I won't go into the stats about why that is. But one of the things that means is that there's some flexibility in how often we're making a mistake. And that's one of the factors that influences that is how careful and constrained we are in how we do our research. So if we're very meticulous, if we're very careful, we follow a strict plan, then in the best case scenario, when there's no real effect, 5% of the time, we'll think that we saw an effect that's not actually there. But that's flexible because if we get sloppy, if we allow ourselves multiple chances, we allow ourselves to peek at our data multiple times, or we say, oh, you know what? I see that my analysis didn't work, but in retrospect, I should have realized that it would only work in women and not in men, so I'm going to redo the analysis just in women. Or, you know, there's all kinds of things you can tell yourself after the fact if your result didn't come out the way you thought. It's very, very easy to convince yourself that actually there's a better way to test that, there's a different way to analyze the data, and keep looking until you find something significant. And when you allow yourself to do that, then your error rate could be much, much higher than 5%. And so that's what corollary number four says, is that the greater the flexibility, then the less likely the research finding is to be true. So the more chances you give yourself to peek at your data, to analyze it different ways, the more likely you are to make a false positive, to think that there's something there when in fact there's not.
Okay, let's see if we can translate that into slightly more lay terms. Mm-hmm. What you're saying is that there's a certain kind of, if you design a study a certain way, then you can kind of look at the percentages. What are the percentage like that your study is likely to be true? And you can kind of come up with a number. And I don't think we have to go into that particular number now. But so what happens is people do that and they see, well, it's most likely that my study is true around that. But this is the big but. That only works in a very particular scenario. Mm-hmm. So people tend to substitute a kind of a generalized statistical pattern for in place of what they're really supposed to be doing, which is carefully doing their study. Mm-hmm. So instead of doing every study as carefully as they can, they kind of just get a little lackadaisical about sort of the statistical percentage.
Well, and I don't want to paint scientists as malicious or anything. They want to give themselves every chance to find something if something is there, right? So you do a study, you spend months or maybe years and lots of money, lots of time collecting the data, and then you have your one shot that, you know, in the canonical way of doing science with these p-values, you're supposed to have one shot, one test to analyze your data, and it's either significant or it's not. And then let's say it's not significant. That means you can't publish it in the world the way science is today, which is a whole nother problem. We don't publish null results. That's changing, but that's very much the case. So what are you going to do? Just throw it away and walk away and start over? No, there might very well be something you can learn from the data. So it would be wrong to just walk away. But then it becomes really, it's a slippery slope from there to saying, okay, well, I'm going to look at it this way. I'm going to look at it this way. And that's okay. But the problem is we look at it every which way until we find something interesting and significant. And then we write that up as if that was the only thing we looked for. And that's the problem. If we admitted, well, I first tried this and then I tried that and it was the 18th try that I got it to work, at least then we would be able to calibrate and say, okay, well, there might be something there, there might not, we don't know yet, but you found something worth following up on.
Because then the statistical pattern wouldn't be the same.
Right, we would interpret the statistics differently.
So the sad fact at the basis of the problem of corollary 4 is that science is done by human beings.
Yes, okay. Yes. And in fact, corollary 5 also. That's kind of the
okay,
theme.
So let's very quickly go over corollary 5 then.
Yeah, so corollary 5 is that the more scientists have a personal vested interest in the result coming out a certain way, the more likely they are to find what they're looking for and it's actually not there. Mm-hmm. And that just means scientists are human. Really, that's all that means.
Yes.
So if we have financial interests or we have political interests or we have, you know, ego in the theory being true, that's going to bias how we interpret the results. And we know that about humans, right? And that's one of the core findings, in fact, of
social psychology. Exactly what I was thinking.
And ironically, it's hard to convince even social psychologists that as scientists, they are subject to those biases too, that they should not trust themselves to be perfectly objective. And actually, there's some empirical work. I just read a paper this morning where they asked scientists and non-scientists about their stereotype of what scientists are like. How rational are they? How objective are they? How much integrity do they have? And everybody agrees that scientists are better than non-scientists on these dimensions. And that's crazy, frankly, to me. I don't think scientists are any more rational or objective or have more integrity than non-scientists. And it's dangerous to assume that they do, because then we don't put the protections in place to make sure their biases don't affect their results.
Well, you can see why people might think that. I don't think, I mean, again, as a social psychologist, I mean, one could call this a moment of wishful thinking, maybe.
Yes.
I mean, we would like to think that those scientists, when they put on those white coats, right, you know, isn't that supposed to
and
mean something?
And it's true that all of us, you know, those of us working at universities and doing research have PhDs. And many probably could have chosen to go and make much more money in industry. So maybe that's a sign that we're more interested in pursuing truth than we are in making a lot of money, I guess. But it's still the case. We're still motivated by our own personal success, because every human is.
Right.
And in fact, our incentive structure is such that we must find something in our data, because otherwise we don't get the grant money, we don't get the publication, we don't get the job, we don't get tenure. We don't get recognition in the media. All of these rewards are contingent on us finding something that the journals think is worth publishing. And what the journals think is worth publishing is significant, interesting, sexy results. So for us to be completely objective and rational would mean that we were not responsive to incentives. And I have yet to meet a human who's not responsive to incentives.
Right. As a matter of fact, that would be a pretty interesting person to imagine what that person would be like.
They probably would never eat.
Right. Well, you wouldn't want them in your psychology experiment, right? Because they would throw off your psychology experiment. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to come back and continue to talk about the question of the reliability of research findings. So stay with us. So, welcome back to Office Hour. If you're just joining us right now, then this is your host, Naomi Janowitz, and I am talking with Professor Vizier from the psychology department, and we're talking about all of the issues that erode trust in science, all of the pressure scientists are under to publish research, to find something in their data, to get their promotion through the faculty, system, to get their pay raise, to get their glory. And so what we're going to turn now a little bit first is to the question of how can we fix this? What kinds of things can we do to improve it? Because after all, this is not something that was given down by the gods, right? This is the system that's set up by the people who do research and do science. So what we're going to look at first is from the famous paper, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. What did he say as the way that scientists should go in order to gain back some of the reliability that we wish they had?
Yeah, he had a few recommendations. So one of them, which is actually pretty obvious when you think about it and maybe a little bit circular, is to pick hypotheses that are more likely to be true a priori on their face. So I think what he's saying there is stop trying to find really counterintuitive things. And this is, I think, something that psychology in particular has probably fallen prey to.
Yes.
And one thing I would want to tell listeners is when you hear something in the news or you read it on HuffPost or BuzzFeed or whatever, and it sounds too good to be true, you should listen to your gut on that. Not completely. You shouldn't be completely closed-minded about it, but that's one sign that it's less likely to be true. If it sounds too good to be true, that should be a strike against it.
Well, I think that's hard. I think that's a hard point. I think actually we find that somewhat disappointing, and I'm sure that the world of journalism finds it somewhat disappointing.
Yes.
Because, finding out that what we know is, what seems to be true sort of is true is not very exciting.
It's not fun, yeah.
So I think that's a really important point to keep in mind, that we do want to look for the new, the novel, the exciting, the counterintuitive, something that just seems fresh.
Mm-hmm. And journalists exaggerate that bias, right? So already the scientific journals want the thing that's going to be clickbaity because they're evaluated based on how many clicks and downloads and citations they get. And then the science journalists come along and they are even more interested in the clickbaity things, the things that you will never guess what the conclusion is, right?
And I guess in following up then on his corollary 4 and 5 that we were talking about, the incentive then would be to work your data set over and over again until you find something that you didn't expect.
Right.
Exactly.
So I think the idea that scientists should maybe actually focus on things that we suspect are probably true and start there is probably good advice, but we have to be open-minded, right? The whole point of science is to not rely on our intuition, so we do want to stay open-minded to things that are counterintuitive.
Right.
But we've probably shifted a little bit too far in that direction.
Okay.
He also talks about meta-analysis as maybe a way that we can increase our certainty in a finding, but I actually think that's a problem. And in psychology, we've learned, so meta-analysis is when you combine the results of multiple studies. But the problem is if each of those studies itself is biased and untrustworthy, then combining them can actually compound the error and the bias if they're all biased in the same direction. So I think a lot of people think that meta-analysis is what's going to save us because if 100 different people across 100 different labs all publish results in the same direction, then it must be true. One of the things we're learning from psychology is actually sometimes even then it's still not true. It's possible to get 100 false positive findings published in the literature because of these different problems that he's highlighted.
I understand that. And I think that's a point worth re-emphasizing again for our listeners, that because meta-analysis is held up as some kind of super duper secret thing is going to prove like whether you should eat carbs or not.
Right. And I think every scientist goes through a phase where they think that's the answer. And I went through that phase a few years ago where I thought, this is it. Meta-analysis is the answer. And then you learn more about it and you realize that it can't get around the bias that's in the individual studies. So you compile a bunch of biased things and you still have bias. It's a problem. So I think the only solution really is to start from scratch and do studies the right way from the beginning. And then if each study is rigorous, then the meta-analysis will be really, really useful. But doing meta-analyses on existing studies that have all the problems that he lays out probably isn't going to help.
Right.
And so one way of doing studies going forward, he talks about the registration of studies, pre-registration, which is basically just writing down ahead of time what you're going to do and what your prediction is and how you're going to test your prediction. And if it comes out this way, that means I was right. And if it comes out that way, that means I was wrong. So it's kind of tying yourself to the mast and saying, this is how I'm going to test my theory. This is what it would look like if I was right. And this is what it would look like if I was wrong. And I'm not giving myself any wiggle room.
Well, that's a frightening thought.
Yeah, but it's also probably how third graders think science works, right?
Yes.
How like we were taught when we're young that science is supposed to work.
Yes, we did have to write that down. And not only that, my main memory of that is that we wrote it down in books that you couldn't rip the piece of paper out of. Right. In other words, there was a commitment there to a certain kind of way, saying this is what I said, that was not true in other classes. Right. So maybe there is something residual about that, and yet you're saying that maybe that was true when you had Mrs. Orr in third grade, but that later as a grown-up scientist, it's not that simple.
Right, well, and because of the incentives, right? It's in our interest to not tie our hands, to give ourselves as much flexibility as possible so that we can discover something and claim that we predicted it. But I think we really need to crack down on it. Predict needs to mean predict. And now we have the technology. There's lots of websites where you can pre-register and timestamp your prediction and show that you wrote it down before you collected the data.
And those really are like those science lab books because you can't get that page. You can't pull that page down.
Yeah.
So if you're just joining us now on Office Hour, today we're talking about the reliability of research studies and whether or not we should trust science or not, which is certainly a hot issue in America today. And so we're going to turn now to one of the papers that's written by our guest today from the psychology department, Professor Vazire. That's V-A-Z-I-R-E. And the study is called Quality Uncertainty Erodes Trust in Science. And I am wondering for the audience whether they can download this paper themselves.
It is. It's open access. Mm-hmm. So if you Google my last name and quality uncertainty, you should be able to find it. The name of the journal is Calabra Psychology.
Okay. Yeah. And now we have e-scholarship, where all UC faculty are supposed to have...
that's right.
We're all trying to learn to put our papers up there.
Yeah.
So if you want to download another, it's nice and short, and you'll feel very smart if you read it through. And it'll give you an idea of the discussion about... Do you trust science? Should you trust science? And how might you trust science a little more? So I was very taken by this paper. I thought that the way in which you made it very accessible to readers who may not understand everything about statistics is by giving us a very vivid model that we can think about, which is not a super complicated model. It's something that's we've all encountered in life, which is the model of the used car.
Yeah, so full credit, I didn't come up with that myself. It's the economist Akerlof, I'm not sure how you say his name. So he came up with that, and he got a Nobel Prize, actually, for his work. So he used the used car market as an example of what happens when there's an asymmetry between what the buyer knows and what the seller knows. So in selling a used car, the seller can know that there's defects in the car and can hide that from the buyer. And if that's the case, then buyers of used cars, they don't know which ones are the lemons, which ones are the bad cars. But they know that there are lemons out there, and they know that they don't know. They know that they don't have the full information, that there's this information asymmetry that leads to what Akerlof called quality uncertainty. So they just have uncertainty about evaluating any product. They can't tell which ones are the good ones, so they lose trust in the market completely because they know that the seller has information that they don't. They can't evaluate which ones are the good products.
Right. And we even see from the social psychology point of view, we are introduced to the character, the used car salesman.
Exactly.
So then we even have a character in American society who's the person who you don't trust because you don't have to have a Nobel Prize to have a feeling like, I don't think I know what's going on here. I lack important information.
And it's a matter of transparency, right? They're allowed to withhold information. You have no way of knowing what they're withholding. And so you know that you can't evaluate if it's a good product or not. And when I read that paper, it occurred to me that this is a really good analogy for scientific publications as well, because right now in many fields, including my field, it's not the norm that the author has to tell you how they got their result.
Right.
So it's kind of like if they're selling you their result, but they're telling you can only look at the exterior. So it's like if someone was selling you a used car and said, but you can't look under the hood. You have to decide whether to buy it or not just based on the exterior. That would be crazy, but that's basically the situation we're in evaluating scientific products, not just the reader reading a published article, but even the editor and reviewers who are engaging in peer review, trying to decide, is this rigorous enough to be published? We don't have the information we need. We don't have the raw data on which the analyses are based. The author doesn't have to tell us everything that they tried. They don't have to report every study that they tried, every analysis that they tried. So all we get is their chosen cherry-picked result. And then we have to say, do we believe it or not? And we're in the same position as someone buying a used car who has to do it without knowing all the information that they
walk around and they kick the tires.
Yeah,
isn't that what we do? They kick the tires and they feel good, or they just say, we might pause for a moment and think about whether the other segments of society that operate in the same way, Do we buy things that we don't know what's under the hood?
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting that you took it from the used car to science. I think in general, it's a very interesting question. I remember that once somebody was visiting from Europe, I was talking with them about the disclosure laws that we filled out when we were selling our house. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, why would you ever tell anybody there was something wrong with your house when you're selling a house? I said, well, because that's the law here, you can't pretend it did everything. And he said, oh, I so wish that had been where I lived, because there was water flowing down the inside of the apartment. Yeah. We didn't know that till we moved in. Yeah. So the general question of the social role of what we call disclosure laws, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, where you have to give people the maximum amount of information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so that's a theme much bigger than we can use for today. I think really the question is how you use that then, on particularly today, the question of improving scientific research.
Mm-hmm. So I feel like transparency is just a first step. It's just a bare minimum that we should expect of scientists. And I agree with you. There's a lot of domains where we should expect transparency, not just science. But I think it's especially imperative in science, because we claim that we're different from other ways of knowing.
Yes.
We claim that we're different from appeals to authority or intuition. And the basis of that claim is that we're willing to make the evidence on which our claims are based available for scrutiny, available for others to verify. And in fact, the motto of the Royal Society of Science, the oldest still existing scientific society, is take no one's word. And that's the ethos of science, is I'm not going to tell you to believe me because I said so. I'm not going to tell you to believe me because I have a PhD. I'm going to let you scrutinize and pick apart and see if you can come to the same conclusion when I show you everything I did. I show you my methods, my procedures, and my data. So why we have this special status in society is because we're willing to be scrutinized and to tell you exactly what we did. So we have to live up to that as a bare minimum.
Exactly. We couldn't get back to our third grade science teacher. Yeah. We couldn't just bring her the apple. We couldn't have the good smile. The good handwriting didn't help. We got through a lot of stuff on good penmanship, It just wasn't going to help.
Yeah.
And I do think that that's an important point, and we should pause and just really emphasize that partly the idea of disclosure is related to the size of the claim, mm-hmm, that you're making about what's under the hood.
Right. And so if transparency is the first step, the next step is then transparency allows you to calibrate your confidence based on how strong the evidence is. So if I just give you my result and I say, trust me, this is the real result.
Right.
Okay, that's not very good. But if I give you my result and I say, I think this result's really solid, but I also give you everything you need to look under the hood and test it out and take it for a test drive and so on, and you can see, well, your result only comes out when I stand on my left leg and bend over this way and squint my eyes. So I don't actually think it's that robust. You know, so what the analogy there is, if I analyze the data slightly differently and the result goes away, I might not believe it as confidently. I might have less confidence in that result. And that's okay. We can disagree on how strong the result is, but at least now I have the information I need to decide how confident I should be in the result. And that's again, the bare minimum I think that we should expect from science.
Terrific. So if you're just joining us now, we're talking about the reliability, the paper, quality, uncertainty erodes trust in science. And we're talking about the question in particular that the paper recommends five steps. It details five steps that scientists should make. Now, I notice here you say that this is a minimum. It doesn't necessarily, mm-hmm, guarantee it, mm-hmm, but it's sort of like what we would call, again, a good enough scientist. What at a minimum do we want to let somebody, you know, parents are not supposed to kill their children. They're supposed to be reliably feeding them, you know, and then there's a lot of range. You know, they don't necessarily have to take them to soccer every Saturday, but, you know, what's in a good enough range? So it's a much trickier question about what is the minimum in science. Mm-hmm. I think that that's a question that probably most people who aren't scientists really wouldn't have much of a sense to how to begin to even think about that. Because we have an idea of what we want in a car, but I'm not sure we know.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say that people who aren't scientists don't have a sense about it, because I would say that in many fields, scientists have lost their sense about it because we're so, you know, we're chasing the grant, we're chasing tenure, et cetera. We've kind of lost sight of why we went into this, that it was about finding the truth, and that there are things we need to do, precautions we need to take to protect ourselves from our own biases and so on when we're searching for the truth.
Okay, so let's go over now with Professor Vizier. What are the six minimum steps that scientists should take for themselves, as you're saying, mm-hmm, for themselves, to remind themselves, as well as for everybody else out there, mm-hmm, so that they can have a sense that, no, there's a different social role for a used car salesman than there is for a scientist. So we're going to try to outline these as simply as we can so that they make sense.
Yeah. So the first one is to share your data. So if you're publishing an empirical finding that's based on data, then you should make the data publicly available or at least available to other researchers. And there's going to be exceptions when, you know, there's confidentiality issues or ethical or legal issues. But the default should be that if the data are legally and ethically shareable, the default should be that they're shared. And now there's plenty of online repositories where we can do that.
Well, I'm quite struck by that. I think, again, in sort of our idea of just people who are just like reading the paper and looking for what new scientific stuff has come out about dieting or whatever. I think people probably aren't aware of the fact that data isn't shared.
No, it's not. In fact, so in psychology, most journals, when you publish a paper, you sign a contract saying that if another researcher asks for your data, you have to share it. And there's been a lot of research now showing that when another researcher asks for the data, they don't get it. Most of the time, the email is just never answered, or the person says, oh yeah, I have it somewhere, I'll get back to you, and they never get back to you. And again, it's not malicious, it's just we don't have really good hygiene about keeping our data in a way that other people can understand it. So it should just be the default that when you submit a paper, you also upload your data to some repository and other people can find it.
Okay, so if we're talking about the implementation of that, so we understand what that means, that just means, again, back to your third grade science notebook, that you have to show your work.
Exactly.
You have to, and it has to be available. Your teacher doesn't want you, just wants to actually see your notebook.
Yep.
You know, and much like math, you have to show your work. You have to actually be able to share it with somebody else.
Exactly.
And I imagine that that's much more complicated because you must be talking about big scale, sharing of big scale data.
Yeah, that varies from field to field. But also, again, technology is catching up so fast that that's usually not a hurdle.
Okay, well, that's good to know because you think of the idea of, you know, that this massive amounts of data can be something that it might be just, you know, momentarily give people pause to think about how are we going to share all the kind of data that people are.
Yeah, it definitely takes time. Like in my lab, you know, our data sets have tens of thousands of variables, so we are on the bigger side. And so we had to make a code book that explains what each variable is and when it was measured and how it was measured and so on. And that took us about a year just to make the code book.
Wow.
But actually, we should have been doing that anyway, not just to share it with other people, but for ourselves. When my graduate students graduate and my new students come in, they don't understand what the variables are.
Terrific.
So it's good hygiene anyway.
Okay.
So number two is that if you're going to predict something, you should write down the prediction. And again, that seems obvious, but in psychology, and I suspect it's not at all specific to psychology, but we coined the term, we realized that it was common practice to actually say you predicted something after the fact. And we call that harking, and it stands for hypothesizing after the results are known.
Uh-huh.
So usually a hypothesis should come before you know the results, but if you find something in your data and then you write it up as if you had predicted it, we call that harking. So number two is just saying, don't hark. So if you did really predict it ahead of time, then write it down ahead of time, timestamp it, and then you get to say that you predicted it ahead of time. And it's okay if you didn't. If you stumble on something, then that's okay to report it too, just don't claim that you predicted it.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me because we always hear these famous experiments where somebody's working on something and they find something completely different.
Unexpected.
And I don't think we hold that against scientists, the idea that they deal with the unexpected.
Yeah. And then the key is to follow up on it before we should be confident in it. Because if it was something you stumbled upon, then there's a greater chance that it's actually a statistical, you know, outlier.
Well, harking.
So what UNAD is
yeah, I think
about.
That's a good thing. Maybe we should all add harking to our just general social psychological vocabulary or just being part of American society, because I certainly hear that from my students at times, you know, finding something after it has been proven and retroactively. We call that sometimes within the religious traditions, they're prophetic things that are actually said after the fact and are presented as prophecy.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think, an important tool, and that's a new vocabulary for
and
us to have.
And it's really easy to convince yourself that you did predict it. That,
right.
And in fact, I have papers that I have co-authors on, and we disagree about whether we predicted the result. We have very different memories. Like, one of us thinks that we serendipitously found this thing and weren't looking for it, and another one of us thinks, no, I remember we were looking for it. And we're all good people with good intentions. It's very easy to convince yourself that you were looking for, that you had, that's what you were looking for all along.
I think that's a very, very true human trait. Mm-hmm. And I certainly see that a lot with my students who often point out to me that a later text says something that seems to be a fulfillment of an earlier text. And I always point out to them that the later text is later. Mm-hmm. So it's not too hard to be a fulfillment of something in a later text. Mm-hmm. But it's as if somehow we don't, We have our own way in which we understand the relationship between cause and effect and how the things. So,
and again, I think that's deeply ingrained in humans, just to want to see patterns.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so we've got two down.
So number three is just report all the studies you did. So this is also a common problem. We call it the file drawer problem, where you try a study, and if it doesn't work, you put it in the file drawer. And then you keep trying, and the ones that do work are the ones you publish. And again, this isn't malicious, but partly it's that journals don't want to see those failed studies. So it's very hard, actually, to be honest and report all of them, because journals often don't want to hear it.
And they can just make you feel depressed.
And it just makes the story messier, right? It's not as neat and tidy of a story. Number four is to report if you did any manipulations of your data. So if you had to transform a variable, or you had to exclude some people because they weren't paying attention, or, you know, it depends on your field. You might have different reasons for tweaking your data. That you should always report what you did, and then let the reader decide if that was a justifiable decision. And ideally, you would also report what the result looks like if you hadn't done it, or if you had done it a different way.
Right. Sharing all of that.
Yeah.
And then the last one?
And the last one is report all the analyses you tried. So this is, again, going back to this flexibility idea that Ioannidis talked about. It's that if you had to try it with and without, you know, age as a covariate before you got it to work, you know, if you tried the analysis a bunch of different ways, you should report all of those results. And if only one of them is statistically significant, you can try to sell that result. Good luck. But if you can show that, look, any way you analyze the data, it comes out significant, or you know, 80% of the time, when the ways that I analyze the data, it came out significant, then that's a lot more convincing.
Terrific. Well, we're going to take a quick break for some public service announcement, and then we're going to come back and talk about some more about the reliability of research findings. And so stay with us here on Office Hour. So welcome back to Office Hour. Welcome back. And we're now beginning the third and final segment for today with our visitor, Professor Samin Vizier, to talk about the reliability of science. And we just outlined from her paper, Quality Uncertainty Erodes Trust in Science. Again, a great title. We were talking about the importance of a good title, so that's a very, very good title. We talked about the five recommendations that she made to help science just be less like used car sales with not knowing what's under the hood. Now that you've outlined these, I'm just curious as to a couple points about them. How it sounds to me like they're fairly easy to implement. You're not asking for anything that's too complicated, but they are somewhat maybe time-consuming.
They're time-consuming for sure, so they slow down the research process, which, you know, making things more rigorous, raising the standards is almost always going to slow things down a little bit. I mean, I think we were going recklessly fast before. But one problem with that is that the expectations of researchers haven't slowed down. So if we're asking people to slow down to take these steps, but their committees evaluating them for jobs or for tenure or for grants aren't changing their expectations, then there's going to be this gap, and there's going to be some scientists caught in the middle where there's this penalty. If you do these things, that's great, you're a better scientist, but sorry, you're not going to get the job or the grant or the tenure. So at the same time that we're trying to change these research practices at the individual level, we also need to change the culture in science, the way that people are evaluated, what the expectations are of scientists, and how they're rewarded.
Right. So it's going to involve a lot of, you know, trickle down effects, or trickle up or trickle sideways effects. Yeah. Is there a pope of science?
No.
I mean, who's in charge here?
Yeah, there's a lot of gatekeepers. So there's deans of universities who decide who have a lot of say in what the standards are for tenure and promotion. That those are really important people to get their ear. There's the grant agencies that decide who get grants. There's the journal editors and the societies that run the journals, that choose the journal editors. All of those people have a lot of power. The problem is, and I'm going to be a little bit blunt here, is that there's a correlation between having those positions and being older. There's also a correlation between liking the status quo and being older. So part of the challenge that those of us who are trying to implement these changes are facing is that a lot of the people who are in the position to implement these changes think that everything's fine with the system as is. That's a system they were raised in. They succeeded in that system. So it's pretty threatening. I think there's a lot of resistance to the idea that the way we've been doing things is not good enough, right? Mm-hmm. That's a pretty threatening thing to tell people who've been doing it that way for 30 or 40 years, who've been successful under that system, to say, actually, it was inadequate. We need to raise our standards. And to get those people to implement those changes, to change the incentive structure, that's really hard, but we have to do it. Otherwise, we're asking young scientists to do as we say, not as we did, and to try to come up in the same culture, but without the same advantages that we had, the same kind of loopholes and shortcuts.
Well, doing unscientifically looking into your crystal ball, where do you think the biggest sticking points are going to would be as people look around for the you know, sort of just the general way in which people trust science? People certainly feel, I think, discouraged. I always use dieting as the example, just because the advice is so diametrical, and people click by those on their online newspapers. I think people have just got to the point where they just don't believe anything anymore. So I don't know. I'd be curious where you think or maybe you don't want to say again, because as a young person in the system, I don't know how much.
Well, I have tenure, so I'm okay. Yeah. I think that, honestly, the hardest thing is going to be to get people to recalibrate their intuitions about what's real, because we see these like mind-blowing findings published and get media attention, you know, telling you that you can change your life or change your marriage or, you know, become
or
happier.
Lose weight easily,
just by doing these three easy things or this 10-minute intervention or whatever. We need to recalibrate our expectations that those things, many of them are probably not real or not as effective as they've been presented to us. And I think it's going to be really hard for scientists to accept once we do these things, we share our data, we pre-register our predictions. I think we're going to find that the truth is a lot less exciting than the truth we've been used to.
Okay,
that wasn't
so
true.
Stay tuned for a lot of boring results. Yeah, I mean, this is what you're promising
us. It's interesting, actually. So my field, there's social psychology and there's personality psychology, and I have a foot in both. And a big criticism of social psychologists that they make of personality psychologists is that personality psychology is boring. And they're really worried that if they do these things, you know, if they start pre-registering and being really careful and so on, they're going to become boring like personality psychology. And there's a real worry there, because social psychology gets a lot more media attention,
yes,
a lot more money,
absolutely,
a lot more everything. So I understand the fear, you know, that the funding's going to get cut, that nobody's going to respect us, that we're not going to get any attention if all we're doing is showing things that people already knew,
right,
or thought they already knew.
And people will ask their mother, right?
Yeah, right.
The idea, you know, someone who seems to, and that. So, well, I think that's extremely interesting. And now I want to just spend a little bit of our last minutes on the show to branch out a little bit, because obviously this is a time in American society where science is quite under attack, mm-hmm, I think in a way in which it just hasn't been in the past. Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with anything that you have put in this paper.
Right.
You know, in other words, this is all wonderful and great and important.
Yeah.
This is an argument scientists should have. But at the same time, we now know that universities, for the first time, you know, mm-hmm, more than 50% of Republicans say the universities are not valuable because, mm-hmm, they're not considered to be useful. Mm-hmm. Tremendous amount of scientists are getting out of the labs and onto the streets and getting, mm-hmm, politically active. Mm-hmm. And as some of the signs I saw at the March on Science said, you know, things are really bad, either when librarians march or when scientists march.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I saw the introverts are here.
Right,
like, that's how bad things are.
So scientists. Yeah. So I don't know if you have any thoughts for us about what's happened and how that relates to,
yeah,
your somewhat more esoteric studies you're leading,
yeah,
us through.
So this is something I've thought a lot about, the connection between that broader political phenomenon and then this like kind of infighting among scientists,
yes,
about replicability, because it's something on boards that I sit on of scientific societies, there's a lot of hand-wringing about if we air our dirty laundry in public and we talk about the failed replications, the null results, the things that don't work in science, is it going to get even worse? People are going to lose,
yes,
faith in us even more. And my answer to that is, maybe this is too idealistic, but one of the things that makes science special is the idea that it's self-correcting, the idea that we will admit when we were wrong and we're more interested in the truth than we are in being right or promoting ourselves. That's what it's supposed to be about. And it's one of the few domains in the world, in life, where that is the higher standard. It's not about self-promotion. It's not about protecting your brand. It's about coming out and saying, yep, we were wrong. We thought this, and then we found this, and we were wrong. And so if we show the world that we're doing that, and that's what we're doing with this replicability crisis, mm-hmm, and with investing so much time and energy into replication studies. So psychology has now invested in these gigantic multi-site replication studies to test whether our classic textbook findings are real. And that, who does that? That's not furthering anybody's career. The people who are spending time on that are just doing it for the good of science, just doing it to find the truth. And if we advertise that and we frame it that way, that, look, we are doing the work of self-examination and self-correction, and very few institutions do that. Most institutions are worried about protecting their reputation or their bottom line. Science is going to tell you when we were wrong. We're going to scrutinize ourselves, and we're going to come clean when we led you astray. I think that's the best way to bolster our reputation, not to try to produce more shiny, flashy results.
Okay, and I certainly understand that point, and I want to emphasize it again, that there is a relationship between these kinds of studies you're doing and the general discourse on science, mm-hmm. which is to make sure that when science is presented to the world, to the larger community, it's presented as most willing to say, we've rethought this. Mm-hmm. You know, we thought there were a certain number of planets. Mm-hmm. You know, we thought the Earth was flat. Mm-hmm. We thought, you know, yeah. whatever it is we thought, mm-hmm. we have now better ways of studying it and yeah. testing it, and we've come up with a new theory, mm-hmm. and that scientists can lead us mm-hmm. and being willing to rethink and restudy. And I think that that's very interesting. I don't know whether you have any thoughts as a social psychologist about the fact that sometimes information doesn't seem to be important. We were talking, yeah. one of the things that's going to be covered in the show next week is how little information changes people's minds about white privilege.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether the scientists, do you bang your head against the wall and just, or you just say, I'm not going to think about the fact that sometimes information doesn't.
No, I think that's something we need more research on, right? We need to figure out a way to get information to matter to people more than it does. Or when it doesn't, when people are resistant to information, we need to figure out how to get them to think differently, how to reach those people in those situations where they're very motivated to believe something. And that's what makes me want to fix science, is there's such important questions like this. That's a social psychological question.
Yes.
And instead of spending our time doing irreproducible, flashy stuff, we should be spending our time doing very serious, very rigorous work on these kinds of questions that society depends on knowing the answer to.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. And believe you me, if you find some good findings on that, we'd love to have you come back on the show. Questions that I wanted to raise that are, again, fairly broad-based mm-hmm. and are sort of about your field. Is it possible that some of the things that you study or that we study at the university that we are now working very hard on quantifying are not quantifiable? And I realize that may be me over in the humanities speaking mm-hmm. to someone over in social psychology, but I often wonder whether one of the problems with the findings is that they're asking to quantify things that just are not quantifiable. Are there things in the world that are not quantifiable? Yeah. That's a very broad intellectual question, but since I have you here and mm-hmm. I have opportunity to open that question, and I wonder whether some of our listeners don't wonder about that as mm-hmm. well, mm-hmm. whether there are just some things that the kinds of studies you're doing don't do well in terms of, mm-hmm. of findings.
I do think there are things that are not quantifiable. I don't think that psychology is trying to quantify a lot of things that are not quantifiable, but we are trying to quantify a lot of things that are very, very difficult to quantify.
Yes.
So I have a friend, you know, in psychology, we get beat up a lot for being a soft science, and I think that's true. We're not a hard science. We're not a physical or natural science. We're social science. For the most part, psychology is very broad, but most of psychology is social in the social science side of things. And I have a friend who actually calls it the hardest science. So it's not a hard science, but it's much harder than a lot of hard sciences in terms of operationalizing, which just means turning the thing that you're interested in into a quantifiable number. That can be very hard. If you're studying happiness, what is the best way to quantify happiness?
Exactly.
Or right. I study personality. I study self-knowledge. It's super hard to quantify. And most of my work is on methods because I'm trying to tinker with different ways to measure how much self-knowledge somebody has. And it turns out to be super difficult. I love that challenge, but I think that we need to acknowledge how messy and complicated it is. It's never going to be as precise of a measurement as somebody's height or weight or, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, maybe there's something else then in terms of maybe finding number six to be a good enough science, would be something about trying to deal with the expectations mm-hmm. before you even begin. Is what yeah. kinds of, what are the limitations of what I'm doing, and mm-hmm. What is the kind of humility I have
exactly.
in terms of what I think can be studied
yeah.
here? And you rarely see those kinds of statements being
yeah.
made.
Again, because we're not rewarded for that. Mm-hmm. It's too bad. I mean, I do think, you know, we should get credit for the fact that psychology is trying to predict human or sometimes other animals, but human behavior, which is so multiply determined. It's
yes.
influenced by so many things. It's under the influence of structural and cultural things and their biological systems and psychological systems and so many things, right? So if we can even improve the prediction of what a human's going to do by a fraction of a percent, that should be considered an important incremental advance. And we shouldn't have to sell it as the answer to everything, right? It should be valued just for what it is, which is a small incremental advance.
So we're again talking about the rolling back of expectations
yeah, yeah.
that you don't want to say, this is the one food that you will eat differently and you
yeah.
will magically lose weight.
Exactly.
And the same thing in psychology as well.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you have any thoughts about how to help our listeners evaluate what they run into. This is something that comes up a lot mm-hmm. and has come up with other people that we've interviewed on the show. Because it's one thing, you're an editor of a journal. Mm-hmm. So you have had just the special experience of having read a lot of papers.
Yeah.
And you are an experimenter yourself. Mm-hmm. So you bring a kind of expertise to evaluating any particular study. You have a very broad background in which to place this particular study. I think one of the things that's really difficult for the consumers mm-hmm. of just sort of standard research when it ultimately mm-hmm. comes in the paper mm-hmm. is it's very hard, you know, they read it in the newspaper, it's very right. hard to place it in any context. How yeah. do you even have any idea?
Yeah.
Particularly, as you've said, they tend to contradict mm-hmm. each other. You know, they don't seem to build, you don't right. have a sense of confidence where they yeah. build on each other. They'll mm-hmm. say very diametrically opposed kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And then you're never buy this kind of car right. or only buy this kind of car. Right. You know? Yeah. So I.